But we still sort of have this tendency to think about exports as something good and imports as something bad. It goes all the way back to, say, mercantilism, this idea that we want to sell to the world more than we buy from the world. And unfortunately, every country can't be a net seller, right? It's impossible mathematically, right?
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/AG. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Feed Science Podcast brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm Bob Odker and I'm here today with Dr. Muhammad, and we're going to hope to have some discussion that you'll find interesting and enlightening. So with that, Dr. Muhammad, I'd ask you to introduce yourself, please.
Yes, hello, and thanks, Bob. So as mentioned, I'm Andrew Muhammad with the University of Tennessee. I'm in the Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics, and I've been working on international agricultural trade policy issues and global food demand issues for, man, almost two decades, if not more than two decades. And I currently work on research and outreach activities related to the competitiveness of U.S. products in global markets, and even still advise policymakers on trade issues in Washington.
Well, that sounds very interesting. So today, we're going to talk a little bit about your personal journey in this profession. Would you like to start there? Do you have some highlights there to share with us?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that unless you come from a rural background, you tend not to think about ag-related majors as sort of viable majors in college. And so thanks for this opportunity to at least promote sort of colleges of agriculture to your audience. And so I grew up in New Orleans, even though my grandfather grew up on a farm, and so I'm loosely connected to rural Louisiana through visits and visiting his family and my grandmother's family, but I knew very little about agriculture. And it wasn't until I was an undergrad at Southern University, I was in engineering, didn't have the discipline at the time for engineering, and just wanted to make a change. And someone mentioned to me this major, agribusiness. And obviously my knee-jerk reaction is, well, what is agribusiness exactly? And they explained it this way. It's all activities from the farm gate to the consumer's plate. And that was enough to at least intrigue me. So changed my major to agribusiness, agricultural economics, fell in love with the economic side of it as well as the business side of it. Went on to graduate school, University of Missouri, then the University of Florida. And the one thing I'll say, particularly to potential students, that agricultural fields are fields where you could do all the things you would want to do, say, in a traditional business field or traditional marketing field or even the traditional sciences. But what you find in the agricultural sector is that the demand for students or the demand for graduates far exceeds the supply. And so it's one of those sectors, regardless of where you fit in, where there isn't an employment issue. And in fact, the Secretary of Agriculture puts out a report every couple of years where there's usually about a 30 to 40,000 job shortfall each and every year in agriculture and ag-related fields. And so hopefully that will sort of inspire some students to think about ag-related majors. But it's been a wonderful journey. It's taken me all around the world. It allows me to do work on very important issues. It allows me to advise very important people. And I'd say it's probably one of the best career moves I ever made. Now, mind you, that's no slight to the engineers out there doing quite well.
Well, that is all very true. I really appreciate what you said. And I grew up in agriculture, more the operational, the doing side, and having been in the industry now for 40 years, I've learned the amount of science that's involved in agriculture, and it's really quite astounding. We're just not all a bunch of hicks out here walking around behind horses. You know, I mean, there's a lot of science today.
And a whole lot. Microbiology, soil science, plant science, animal science, vet medicine, and you name it. And then even when you get into things like food science, there's I worked on a project with someone. One of his specialties was sort of the profiles of expensive whiskeys, right? Think about the science of that perfect oaky taste, or that science of how to get vanilla notes from a barrel, right? I was actually impressed. I have friends who study insects, pests, and diseases. I have people who work on turf grass issues. Like, you'd be shocked how much there is in terms of how we think about the world and everything important to the world that you could major in and be productive in and even flourish in, a major that's in the College of Agriculture.
It is. And I'm going to put in a plug, if you don't mind, just for feed mills and operations, which is where my heart is. And there's a lot of very interesting, intricate automation and production that we're doing in these big feed mills now to produce feed. Tons of opportunity for young people that would be interested in getting into, you know, the operations side. And it's wide open. There just aren't a lot of people out there. So, yeah. Well, good. Thank you for that. So I guess what I'm most interested in is your view on some of the recent trade actions that have been going on. And we're certainly in a new time today. Nobody can argue with that. So you'd like to expand a little bit on what these trade actions are and what you see them as the effect of some of those, I think that'd be very enlightening.
All right. So let me kind of take a longer view, if you don't mind. So the way we first thought about international trade, say coming out of the Great Depression and coming out of World War II, right, with the formation of these international bodies like the United Nations and the, but particularly the global agreements on tariffs and trade, right, the GATS agreement. The idea was to grow the global pie, right, that people understood that this idea of, if I erect barriers against you in the name of saving my industries, that policy only works if you do not retaliate. But the problem is countries retaliate, right? And so this retaliation limits international activity. It limits global income, which clearly limits the income of individual countries. And so then the vision was, look, let's try to sort of, instead of erecting barriers, let's decrease barriers, let's liberalize trade, let's grow the global pie. But we still sort of have this tendency to think about exports as something good and imports as something bad. Right? It goes all the way back to, say, mercantilism, this idea that we want to sell to the world more than we buy from the world. And unfortunately, every country can't be a net seller. Right, it's impossible mathematically, right?
Right.
But it doesn't stop us from trying. And so it's nothing for a president, and President Trump is not the first, certainly not, to think about a sector and to somehow feel this sector is at a loss because of global competition, and then think the idea is to erect barriers. Now, here's the downside. When tariffs are erected, or when tariffs are imposed or implemented, that more often than not, you hurt the users of that product more so than you help the actual producers of that product. And so, for example, in the case of steel and aluminum tariffs, more jobs have been lost in those sectors that use steel and aluminum than the jobs gained in the actual steel and aluminum producing sectors. All right, so you end up sometimes doing more harm than good. But President Trump sort of came in, and this is even with his last term, with this idea of trying to fix bilateral trade deficits. That bilateral trade deficits, sort of ipso facto, is evidence that somebody is doing something wrong to the U.S., right? That sort of notion. And so thinking not just about the overall U.S. trade balance, and not even thinking about particular sectors even, but simply looking at the U.S. relative to other countries, in saying that, look, I believe you're an unfair actor in this game of international trade, and we're going to sort of police you and punish you accordingly. Now, the downside is this. We export a lot of our agricultural products. 20% of U.S. agriculture gets exported. 70 to 80% of the cotton we produce gets exported to the world. More than half the soybeans we produce gets exported to the world. So when countries retaliate against these trade actions, they often retaliate against the agricultural sector. And what does that do? As a result, it does two things. It depresses the prices that we receive because it leaves so much of our product on the domestic market. It clearly decreases sales. But what it's also, what it can also do and actually have done is it causes our major destination markets to seek other suppliers. And so within the last couple of years, we've seen the rise of Brazilian agricultural exports surpassing the U.S. in terms of soybeans, when we were once the leading soybean exporter, surpassing the U.S. in terms of wheat, corn, cotton, beef, even poultry, right, which was a much longer sort of time frame when they surpassed us. But the point is that it does not appear that agriculture wins in these type of sort of tit-for-tat tariff, trade war retaliation type actions. And then the downside is most of this isn't even about the agricultural sector, right? That the agricultural sector until recently was pretty much a net exporting sector. And even now that we're a quote unquote net importer, so much of what we import that's counted as ag officially, which is like fresh fruits and vegetables, which is understandable. A big part of this is coffee, like things we don't produce. But an even bigger part is beer, wine, and spirits, which people wouldn't necessarily think about as ag products. Like tequila alone contributes to like maybe one quarter of the so-called agricultural trade deficit that we see now. That's like a $5 billion sort of quote-unquote deficit because you can't produce tequila, but we certainly import about $5 billion of it each year, which has grown quite a bit, by the way. The point I'm trying to say is that despite the well intentions of these trade actions, they tend to lead to unintended negative outcomes, but they also create an uncertainty that causes these countries we deal with to seek partners other than the United States.
That's all very interesting. I have a lot of things run through my mind as you explain that. I guess as being in agriculture, you know, I mean, part of me wants to say it's, you know, it's just unfair to establish a trade situation with some country. And then, you know, we gear up for that, right? We size up for that and production and everything's going good. And then all of a sudden that's just pulled away and we're left to, I guess, suffer the consequences. That seems incredibly unfair and borderline mismanagement to me, I guess.
It is unfair. The one thing Secretary Perdue could say 4 years ago was do no harm to agriculture, right? Especially in the context of the fact that we exported more agriculture than we imported. And that sector being a net exporting sector, he could say to President Trump, we're not part of this problem that you seem to feel we have, right? This time around, I don't know if we have that sort of business or moral leg to stand on, given that agriculture now is also a net importing sector. But I say all that to say, though, that and you use the term unfair, right? These are sort of negotiations between countries. And the thing that I think destination markets often think about is not that sort of what retaliation is going to be best for me economically in response to, say, trade actions by the Trump administration. They're also thinking about, where can I hit the president politically? Who are his supporters, right? And how can I make them suffer for his trade actions? And hence the reason why it's so easy to retaliate against American agriculture, because many of our most rural states are red states, and the hope is to encourage congressmen and senators to sort of cause the president to scale back. Now, well, the one thing I will say is oftentimes the president sort of thinks of trade actions as negotiation tactics. And I kind of get that, meaning that if you have barriers in place, then you have a position from which to negotiate from. If you want other countries to decrease their trade barriers. And then so this recent policy of simply saying we're going to look at tariffs in foreign markets, and then we're going to increase our tariffs to match their tariffs. And it all sounds well and good. But I want to go back to a place where I started, and that is we tend to think about imports as bad. And what we don't think about is the fact that when we import products, we are actually importing inputs. We're not importing final products. And even if we import final products, there's enough domestic value added that takes place from the point of entry to the final consumer, that there's a lot of economic activity and economic growth associated with products we buy from foreign countries. And we lose that value-added economic activity when we restrict imports.
Certainly, certainly. Things like shipping, right, and further processing and
exactly,
and transport and retail and, yeah, sales tax on those items when, yeah, it is a big far-reaching thing, and it's probably much too complicated for most of the political leaders in our country, would be my guess.
Right, but think about this. We mostly import raw coffee that comes from Colombia. When I say raw, I just mean unroasted. It comes from Colombia, Brazil, other Nicaragua, other places in Central and South America, as far east as Vietnam, right? Rwanda, Kenya. And when you go to Starbucks, and not to say you go to Starbucks, and we spend $3.50 on a cup that's clearly the product of imported unroasted beans, you'd be hard-pressed to tell me that that $3.50 is in some way enriching a tree farmer in rural Colombia. That money is going to an American company, American workers, and that's the point that I mean there. Right, that most of that money is really staying here. But if we think about imports as some bad thing, that it's money leaving, we really do lose the nuances of the economic activity and economic benefits that are associated with imported products.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, and that's just true of many imported products, right? I mean, the people that are providing them, cashews and those types of things, they're not the main money makers of the process. Do you think there comes a time? I mean, being in agriculture all the time, I notice, you know, people say, well, we'll put these tariffs on and it'll just be for a short time and then we'll get what we want and, you know, things will come back and everything will be fine. It doesn't always seem to go that way from my side of that deal. I'm curious what your thoughts are on is, do we ever reach a time when we don't become a tool or a pawn or, you know, really, really somebody who's just not even associated with the action, but is, you know, has to suffer the consequences. And I'm really as much as a farmer as anything, I'm asking that question.
Yeah, no, it's unfortunate because even temporary actions have long-term effects. And so the uncertainty that the last trade war created caused the Chinese to make a conscious effort to make investments in South America for agricultural exports to China, right? That they've explicitly invested in South American infrastructure, transportation networks. And so the growth in exports from Brazil to China is in part seen as a return on investment from the perspective of the Chinese. And that action was solely meant to decouple or to decrease the reliance on U.S. agricultural exports for their total agricultural supply. I don't see that turning around. we did have a period where we had a phase one trade agreement with China where they did increase purchases, but during that time they increased purchases from Brazil even more so. So it's not like that agreement really sort of put us back on track. But then the other thing is these actions are not temporary. Like the tariffs that President Trump imposed on China during his first term are still in place. Like President Biden didn't think to get rid of these tariffs. And then many of the retaliatory tariffs, other than certain places where we've negotiated temporary reprieves, are still in place. And so, yes, they're meant to be temporary, but sometimes they end up being permanent, right? And so, for example, or they end up being temporarily sort of like you get a temporary reprieve that gets sort of revisited every year. Like, for example, UK tariffs on agricultural products and say whiskey, which was the big one they retaliated against, that retaliatory tariff is zero, but it gets revisited every year now. Now, and the fact that a tariff gets revisited, meaning that at any given time, a country could decide to reimpose the tariff, like that's the new normal. It adds to the uncertainty of the global sort of business arena, and that uncertainty alone sort of limits trade in some way. Because why would I invest in a particular market, even though the tariff is zero, but a policy is in place saying that any given year we could change our mind, right? Businesses want certainty, and these types of actions, even when we negotiate reprieves, does not alleviate the business environment of the uncertainty.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's just seems very complicated. I mean, it seems to me too that we talk a lot about trade deficits, and that I hear a lot of people talking about, well, we buy so much more from certain countries than they buy from us. But if it's stuff we want, that's really not a bad thing, is it?
Well, and here's what you bring up a good point, Bob. Here's what I think people don't understand. International trade is balanced. Technically speaking, there's no such thing as a trade deficit in the accounting sense when you consider everything traded, including the flow of currency across national borders, right? So we trade goods, and what we have is a goods trade deficit, but we also trade services, right? That accounting firms and law firms in the U.S. actually have businesses, engagements and clients in foreign markets. We actually have a surplus in services, but we also trade assets, meaning that countries invest in the U.S. and we invest in other countries. And there we also have a surplus. And when you think about all the ways in which currency flows across borders, it actually ends up being equal to zero. In the accounting sense, it must be equal to zero. It's impossible. So let me give you a perfect example, right? So you're in the feed mill sector, and someone comes to you and they say, hey, look, and they're from a foreign country. I want so many million bushels of corn. And you give them a price and they say to you, well, I can't pay you in dollars, but I'll pay you in seashells. We have these rare seashells in our country, and they're rare. We've managed them. And so don't worry about sort of erosion of the value of them. They're rare. Let me pay you. And you say, well, what are seashells worth? And he says, well, I don't know. I've never tried to sell them for anything. This is my first international transaction. You would say, well, how many seashells do you say? I'll give you 10 million seashells. You would say, well, okay, figure out how to convert 10 million seashells into currency that I understand the value of, and then I'll make the transaction, right? That's what you would say.
Yeah.
But then let's just say, he said, well, come visit my country. You'll love it. You visit the country and you see this beautiful house overlooking the ocean. And lo and behold, the house is priced in seashells, and you like the house, and you see the price is the same as what he offered you for the soybeans, in that moment you would say to him, I'll take those seashells for my soybeans, but don't give me the seashells, give me the house. In that moment, what you've created is he's created a trade deficit because he's taken in product, but he's also created what's called a capital account surplus that offsets the actual trade deficit. The only reason you made the transaction is you saw something else in the country that you wanted. Otherwise, you wouldn't make the transaction. So meaning countries do not sell more to the United States and buy less from the United States, but for the fact there are other things in the United States they want to purchase, and it's not necessarily goods. Sometimes it's services and sometimes it's assets. Because were it not for that desire to purchase something else, they, like you, would simply say, I don't take seashells, next customer, right? And so hopefully that's the audience understands that. Now, the only downside is some of these assets, or so-called assets, are government treasury bills. And so it is concerning when a foreign country is buying up a lot of U.S. debt, right? So that is... But how you don't fix that problem with tariffs. You actually fix that problem by either increasing taxes or somehow figuring out how to get government spending down to current tax levels, right? Which is a very different thing from tariffs. Tariffs won't fix the quote unquote trade deficit problem. As long as currency flows are coming in other ways, it needs to be offset by actual good flows across borders.
That was very understandable, and I hope that those watching took mind of that. And you know, if that made sense to you, share it. I know so many people that are very confused about this whole trade action thing, and you've made several really good comments here, and I hope our audience is enjoying them. One quick question that I have for you, if you don't mind, is I hear about the tariffs and we're going to put them on because people aren't controlling the drugs that are coming across the country. And, you know, the fentanyl in particular. And I'm as opposed to fentanyl abuse as anybody in the world. Is that fair? Can we really affect that with tariffs, or is that more for the, for the nightly news?
You know, it's a good question. And the real answer to that is I actually don't know. Right. I have a paper that just got published in a journal called Agribusiness, an international journal, on what the tariffs will possibly do to U.S. distilled spirit imports, right? As you could see, that one of my areas is sort of these niche agricultural products and what trade action will do in these sort of niche, high demand, highly differentiated product areas. And I recall writing in that paper, while sort of the effectiveness of tariffs in decreasing migrant flows and the presence of fentanyl in American cities is unknown, what we do know is that tariffs will have this negative impact on what we import, right? And that's the best you can say. We know what tariffs can do and will do, and that is make imports more expensive. And more often than not, that gets translated to the final price to consumers. Sometimes countries actually share the tariff burden. Rarely is it the case that a foreign country bears the full burden of a tariff imposed on them. More often than not, the case is we pay our own tariffs, right? Because it's importers who must pay the U.S. government. And if those importers can negotiate lower prices in foreign countries, sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. Now, so we're thinking about we really have to sort of think about this logical chain. And that chain would be, these tariffs must be bad for Mexico and Canada, such that the government makes more investment in border protection issues, right? Whether it's more. Now, That's the best Canada and Mexico can do. Put more guards at the border. Very much that's the best we can do. Now, unless there's some direct government tie to fentanyl crossing the southern border, or migrants illegally crossing the southern border, what they can do is invest in policing, nothing more. Now, who knows whether that policing would end up being effective to the point where the current president would say, I'm satisfied, let's remove the tariffs, right? And so, and who knows whether that's gonna be a measurable difference. Like, I don't, like, no one, someone's probably gonna study this, in that for every guard at a Canadian or Mexican border, what's the decrease in the amount of fentanyl that gets sold in rural and urban America? Someone's gonna try to come up with that relationship, but truth be told, we don't know. But what we do know is that imports are a tax. I mean, tariffs are a tax on imports, and tariffs will definitely make imports more expensive. That's the thing we know.
And I'm a big fan of measuring things too, but I've learned in my life that oftentimes the measurement comes well after the actual effects that, you know, it may be 20 years before we come up with that data. And by then it'll have changed the society and the economics to a point that it really doesn't matter now because we've already done it, right?
No, that's exactly right.
It's time for our famous three.
Well, listen, this is just really good stuff. We're nearing our time limit here. I have three questions kind of off topic.
No, go for it.
First thing I'd ask you is, so within your expertise, I'm just interested in what your go-to source of information would be, or your, you know, a book or whatever, a study that's just kind of your go-to source of information.
Yeah, no, it's a few things. One, and hopefully you don't mind, I'm not sort of necessarily plugging this organization, but USA Trade Online has been particularly helpful for timely trade issues. Numerous data sets, whether it's UN Comtrade, the United States has two very good, we have two very good data sets, databases, and that's it's US Census as US Trade Online, very detailed. As well as USDA has what's called the Global Agricultural Trade System, a very detailed database. I even pay for subscriptions to Trade Data Monitor. And that gives me sort of data on China, Japan, and other foreign countries. In terms of news outlets, I try to at least stay up with The Economist magazine, and then the daily stories from the Associated Press. I do make an attempt to try to get news from both the right as well as the left to make sure I don't, so I'm not sort of hitting any blind spots, that things that are often ignored by the political right are overly sort of emphasized on the left and vice versa. So I do want to get that. I also try to get different perspectives on news from just sort of the political angle that people often take. Like, for example, just reading sort of right-leaning outlets on how people see USAID and what's going on in terms of firing employees, decreasing its funding, and moving it to under the State Department versus how people see that on the political left. And you'd be shocked that it's a huge difference, right? It makes you think that you're not even looking at the same issue, that the differences in reporting so huge. But yeah, main publications, I'd say my sort of right of center would be The Economist, from time to time The Wall Street Journal, but I do have a subscription to The Economist. Left of center would be The New York Times, but I do also have sort of a subscription, quote unquote, it's free, with NPR, so I do get their daily news feed. And then I consider the Associated Press somewhat in the middle. But obviously, with them being disinvited from the White House for not calling the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America, one would argue they're left of center. But I won't hold that against them. That.
Yeah, it's an interesting time. I'm happy to be alive right now to witness. I missed the forming of the country, so I'm really liking to be here to see this. reshaping, perhaps. So outside of agriculture, then, do you have a favorite book or resource?
Outside of ag, my favorite book in the last like 3 or 4 years, it's older than 3 or 4 years, was Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari, an Israeli author. But it's about a 400, 500 page book on the history of human civilization and how Homo sapiens came to be the main human species to survive, like whether and what was possibly the reason why we persisted and others did not. Real good story. In terms of nonfiction, just read a book called James, I think it's Percival Everett. It's actually about, it's the retelling of Huckleberry Finn from the perspective of Jim.
That's interesting.
Because apparently he's highly intelligent, well-read, and even in his dreams communicates with John Locke and Rousseau and Voltaire. But then when he wakes up, he purposely puts on his slave voice and slave demeanor as a means of protection and code switching. And so it has a lot of the Huckleberry Finn sort of aspects to it, but it's a different story because obviously it's from his perspective. I won't spoil it, but I actually really enjoyed that book. And then I'm trying to think another book that I've read as of late that I thought was real good. Another old one, but I finally just got around to it, is Guns, Germs, and Steel, which is particularly good. And then the other thing I would, at least for me, I don't consider myself neither conservative or liberal in a political sense, in terms of like economically speaking, one could say I lean toward like classical liberalism in terms of free markets. But that said, and you're going to wonder why did that preface be needed? The autobiography of Booker T. Washington is, I was actually surprised at how much I liked it. It's a short book. It's real short, but his journey, and he was one of those people who would be considered quote unquote the first black conservative, right? He was a firm believer in don't try to change the world. Make an effort to better yourself. And as he put it in the Atlanta speech, and I think this is the late 1800s, it's better to earn a dollar in a factory than to fight to spend a dollar in an opera house, right? And that was his idea. Now, mind you, he was speaking against some of the people in the civil rights era at that time. So I get why he's sort of out of favor with some, but I really enjoyed that autobiography. And I think if one could sort of get past conservative liberal splits politically and understand his sort of overarching message, I think people would really enjoy it.
Thank you for those recommendations. And with that, I think we're going to bring this episode to an end. I'd like to thank Dr. Muhammad for joining us here and giving us a lot to think about. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us. I encourage you to share, subscribe, and to always remember that we need to be doing our own thinking whenever we can. So for now, I'm Bob. May God bless you, and we'll see you next time.
Same to you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.